chapter 10, we see Ezra's reaction to the news that many of the children of Israel had married foreign women, which in the backdrop of the big story of the Bible is always a dangerous thing, always leads people astray from God. But there's something that we talked a little bit about on Wednesday night that I wanted to just raise to your awareness again. It's interesting to me that as soon as Ezra gets word about what's going on, what is his immediate response? To pray. And even after he sort of initially says, okay, we've got to do something about this, the people themselves really basically take the initiative. And then Ezra once again goes right back before the presence of the Lord to pray. And I made the point on Wednesday night that it's very easy for us to fall into the trap that you see a lot just in general in our culture. And I illustrated on Wednesday night, whenever there's a mass shooting and there's always people who say our thoughts and prayers are with the victims, there's always then people who say, well, thoughts and prayers aren't going to do anything. Let's pass a law or whatever. And it's easy for us, if we're not careful, to fall into the same trap of forgetting that our first impulse in our work needs to be to remember our complete and utter reliance on God, which is what you see in the case here of Ezra as he goes to God in prayer. And I was thinking about this because next quarter, Lord willing, we're going to study the book of Acts as we focus on evangelism. And yet one of the things that is really striking when you read the opening chapters of the book of Acts is how frequently prayer is mentioned in those chapters. In Acts chapter 2, when the first Christian converts respond to the gospel, the Bible says they continued steadfastly in the apostles' teaching and fellowship and breaking of bread and prayers, the prayers. In Acts chapter 3, the Christians are up at the temple at the time of prayer. And in chapter 4, when the apostles are arrested by the Sadducees, they immediately gather together to pray. And then one passage in particular I wanted to focus on with you this morning. Go over to the book of Acts and go to the 6th chapter, Acts chapter 6. Now, Acts 6 really is designed to be the segue to the story of Stephen and then his trial in Acts 7 and then eventual murder and then the persecution that results. But before we get to the story of Stephen, the opening verses of Acts chapter 6 contain another brief account. And do you remember, and if you don't, just turn and look at it, what is the story there at the opening of Acts chapter 6? What's it about? Yeah, that's exactly right. There's an issue. Some of the widows are not being taken care of as others are, so there's favoritism, and it has broken down on ethnic lines between the Jews who are from Israel and the Jews who are from outside of Israel, what sometimes are called the Grecian widows or the Hellenistic widows. And when the apostles gathered the congregation, you know, recognizing we've got to solve this problem, this could be a very explosive situation otherwise. And what the apostles say to them is, you pick 7 men, and they give the criteria, who will take care of this. But notice, what did the apostles say? We want you to pick men to handle this problem because we have 2 other priorities that we've got to focus on. What are those priorities? The ministry of the word and prayer. That's exactly right. Now, you certainly can't accuse the apostles of inaction. I mean, their activity is very clear in the opening chapters of the book of Acts. But I think that that's just a, to me, that's a striking statement that we are too busy in the word. Now, we get that. That's probably what maybe comes more natural to us. But also, we're so busy praying, we don't have time to do this. So we need other people to carry the load and take care of it. So I just want to draw your attention to this, in, especially because of where we are as a congregation. You know, right now we're involved in the physical construction project for our new meeting place. And so there's a lot of things that are going to be wrapped up in that. And then there's a lot of things that we want to do for each other this year, build up one another. That's what we're focusing on this quarter and building up the church in evangelism in the second quarter, and then building up our faith, and then building up our families. But we can just never forget how vital prayer is to all of this, because it's the recognition of our dependence on God for any of these things to happen. And it's something I don't talk about a lot, probably because I don't feel like I pray nearly like I ought to pray. So it's important to see how often this point is emphasized actually in Scripture itself. And I know, at least for me, it's a really good wake-up call that this is something that I need to be about. So I just wanted to remind you that from what we looked at on Wednesday night in the book of Ezra, in Ezra 10. So we are now going to the book of Nehemiah. In our Bibles, these are two separate books, Ezra and Nehemiah. Originally, though, in the Hebrew Bible, they were one book, Ezra and Nehemiah. And so if it helps you to think we're just moving right into the next chapter of the story that we've been talking about, then that'll be great. Now, let me remind you of some things that we talked about when we started the book of Ezra, especially because a lot of our college students in particular were in some other class. All right, so let me just focus on a few things by way of reminder as we get started here. There is a certain structure to the way the books of Ezra and Nehemiah are laid out. In the first part of Ezra, we have the story of the return of the exiles, and that is equivalent to the first stage of the return from captivity. When Cyrus, the Persian king, says, all of you may go back to your homeland, build your temples, and so forth. So that's stage one of the return. If you imagine the imaginary whiteboard, that's the first step up from down in Babylonian captivity. And that whole process from Ezra 1 to 6 is about a little over 20-year process. You remember, the people initially come back to the land, they build the foundation of the temple, and then there is opposition, and then the king says, hey, you got to stop. And so the work grinds to a halt, and it lays dormant for quite some time. Then a few years later, the prophets Haggai and Zechariah say, hey, we need to get back to work. And they do. And so finally, after about 20 years from when they started, they complete the temple. So that's stage one. The second part of the book of Ezra tells us about the work of Ezra, and sometimes the way we describe this is rebuilding the law in the hearts of the people, helping them to follow what the law says. It's to some extent about the temple, all the procedures and laws that God had given about the temple, but as we also saw there in Ezra 9 and 10, about other matters as well, such as the matter of marriage and intermarriage. So if you think of that whiteboard, this is step two, stage two up from the Babylonian captivity, rebuilding the law. And this stage takes place about 50 to 60 years after the first stage. So there's a pretty significant time gap there between Ezra 6 and Ezra 7. Now, the reason on this slide I have it labeled the work of Ezra part 1 is because later in the book of Nehemiah, Ezra pops up again. And he's going to be a part of the work that takes place there. And so that's why there's Ezra part 1, because there will be Ezra part 2. Now when we come into the book of Nehemiah, Nehemiah is going to represent a third step, a third stage of the return from captivity. And as we're going to see today, what his step or stage focuses on is the rebuilding of the walls of the city. And this takes place about 14 years, 13 years, something like that, from the previous step of the return. So what's going to happen then is there's going to be the work of Nehemiah, part one. Then we're going to see the work of Ezra, the second part of his work, and then the focus on Nehemiah as well. So that's kind of the big picture here of what we're going to be talking about. All right, so with that in mind, let's just turn to Nehemiah chapter 1 and get started here with what Nehemiah tells us about the story. I read one time that you know you're getting old when you injure yourself while you're asleep. You ever heard that one before? I went to bed last night feeling great and woke up this morning and I got a hitch in my good knee. So this could be a very short sermon. today. So some of you are thinking, let's sneak in his house and bash him in the knee every Saturday night, and then we're going to be good to go here, all right? So Nehemiah chapter 1 says in verse 1, the words of Nehemiah the son of Hakaliah. Now it happened in the month of Kislev. So that is basically November, December-ish on our calendar, if it helps you to kind of think of a season or time of the year. And he says it happened in the 20th year. So what he's talking about here is the year of the king. And at this point, the king is this dude right here, Artaxerxes the First. And so if it happens in the 20th year, kind of depending on how you count these out, then we are somewhere around the year 445, 444, depending on how the calendar kind of broke down here. So he says he's in the 20th year of the king. Now, if you look carefully at what it says here, the 20th year, go back to Ezra 7 just for a second. It's kind of give you a frame of reference. If you go back to Ezra 7 and look in verse 7. So when Ezra leads his return, the second phase of the return, what year of King Artaxerxes does it take place in? The 7th. So that kind of gives you your time perspective here. There were, you know, about 13, 14 years from the time of what Ezra did in his phase of the return. All right, so the words of Nehemiah, the son of Hakaliah. Now it happened in the month of Kislev in the 20th year as I was in Susa, the citadel. So, of course, these ancient kings had not only capital cities and palaces, but they also had palaces in other places as well. Kind of like, you know, here in our country, we have the White Houses in Washington, D.C., but then there's also Camp David, the place where a lot of the presidents go to vacation or go up on the weekends. And in the same way, these ancient kings had different palaces in different parts of their empire where they would go. Susa, located right here on the map, was a place where they would often go during the winter time to kind of get a little bit of a break from the weather in the more arid parts of the world. So that's when this happens, and that's where it happens. The month of Kislev, the 20th year of Artaxerxes, as he is in Susa, the citadel. Now, we're going to learn at the end of the chapter, there's a very good reason why Nehemiah is at one of these royal palaces, because he plays a key role in the king's administration. But we'll get to that here in just a bit. So going on now to verse 2, he says that Hanani, one of my brothers. We don't know a lot about Hanani. We do know this. He comes up again later in the book. If you scan over to chapter 7 and look in verse 2, Hanani was somebody that Nehemiah entrusted with an important responsibility. After the wall is completed, he says in Nehemiah 7 and verse 2, I gave my brother Hanani and Hanani, the governor of the castle, charge over Jerusalem, for he was more faithful and God-fearing, a faithful and God-fearing man than many. So somebody whose opinion can be trusted, whose word can be trusted. And it says in verse 2 that Hanani, one of my brothers, came with certain men from Judah. So Nehemiah would be one of those Jews. We've talked about this, you know, at different times. Not everybody went back when they were told they could go back. Not everybody went back in the first phase of the return. Not everyone went back on the second phase of the return. Hanani did go, but Nehemiah is still here in Susa. So these guys have returned from Judah. And naturally, what does Nehemiah ask about? Yeah, how's everything back home? Don't you ask that when you see somebody who's been where you're from and you're living away from home and you get a visitor from back home, you kind of, hey, what's going on? How's everybody doing back home? What's things like back home? And so that's the same here as well. He says in the end of verse 2, I ask them concerning the Jews who escaped, who survived the exile, and concerning Jerusalem. But the news Nehemiah gets is troubling. In verse 3, what's the response of Hanani to Nehemiah's inquiry? trouble right here in River City, right? He says the remnant there in the province who had survived the exile is in great trouble and shame. The wall of Jerusalem is broken down and its gates are destroyed by fire. So, of course, in the ancient world, the ability to defend yourself as a city, really more than anything else, depended on being elevated, being up on a hill, which Jerusalem is, and having walls. I know there's a lot of political discussion right now about building walls. Let's leave that outside of the walls of this building, all right? We're talking about a situation that took place 2,500 years ago. All right, technology has changed since then. So, but in the case of Jerusalem, if you're going to have defenses, you got to have a wall. There's a proverb that says, like a city without walls is a man who cannot control his spirit. A man who can't control his spirit is vulnerable to all sorts of attacks. Just like a city without walls is vulnerable to all sorts of attacks. So when a city doesn't have walls, it is a city that's just laid wide open for ruin and for invasion. And that's the reason there is great trouble and shame. Now, we've actually already learned how this happened. And it's back over in the book of Ezra. So let me remind you of something, okay? Turn back over to Ezra. Go to the fourth chapter. Ezra chapter 4. Do you remember Ezra 4? First of all, tells us about, remember, the people of the land, they wanted to come and help rebuild the temple, and Ezra says, no, you're adversaries. And so they go and rat him out to the king of Persia and stir up trouble. And remember, they say, hey, look at the history books. This city, it's always stirring up trouble. And then if you remember in Ezra 4, Ezra says, yeah, it's just like in other times, where people have opposed us and opposed our work and done the same thing to us. So if you look in Ezra 4 and verse 7, he shifts ahead to talk about something that happened in the time of Artaxerxes. You see that in Ezra 4, 7? And this is where the people say, if you go down to verse 12, be it known to the king that the Jews who came up from you to us have gone to Jerusalem. They are rebuilding that wicked and rebellious city. They are finishing the walls. And then verse 13, now be it known to the king that if this city is rebuilt and the walls finished, what's going to happen? They're going to rebel. They won't pay taxes. They'll stir up trouble. These people do this every time they get a chance. They rebel against the king. And so the king responds to this down in verse 21. Therefore, make a decree that these men be made to cease and this city not be rebuilt. So like a cease and desist order. Verse 22, and take care not to be slack in this matter. Why should damage grow to the hurt of the king? Then when the copy of King Artaxerxes' letter was read before these scribes and their associates, notice what it says at the end of verse 23. They went in haste to the Jews at Jerusalem, and what does it say they did? They stopped them. How? By force. And then it says in verse 24, going back to the present time, just like that happened, they've stopped this building, the temple. What I wanted to see is here is back in Ezra 4, we've already seen the preview of what was going to happen here. So Ezra 4 gives us the explanation for the news that Nehemiah has just received. During the time of Artaxerxes, when this order to build the walls was stopped, not only was the order to build the walls given to tell them to stop building, but in fact there were people who by force stopped the building of the walls and made it cease. And so now you can see in Nehemiah exactly what that meant. There was some kind of attack, a violent effort to stop the rebuilding of the walls of the city. All right, any questions up through Nehemiah so far? We've gotten up through verse 3. Any questions so far? That's a really good question. Ralph's asking, did Hananiah and his cohorts come back to Nehemiah specifically to give him this news? Maybe. You would certainly think that they had that on their minds, right? When they go back. The text doesn't specifically tell us that. And the bottom line is they get the news to him, regardless of whether that was like their priority checklist thing or whether it just happened as Nehemiah asked them how it was going. But you would think if you've got a brother who has the position in government that Hanani does with Nehemiah, that would be something that they would say. No, it's a very good question. Ralph, you can see here, working hard already this morning. He had to lay out for a couple of weeks. So now he's back in the ball game here and trying to restore his gold star status as a favorite student. So we'll see what happens here. All right. So verse 4. What's Nehemiah's response? Yeah, praise. He prays. Just like Ezra. And in fact, as we're going to see in this book, it's so hard to judge personality based on the very limited amount of information you get about these Bible. I mean, really, when you think about it, it's awful hard to create these personality profiles based on the very limited data we get about their personalities. But I do think it's fair to say that at least as they are presented, Nehemiah seems to be a much more aggressive, hands-on kind of person. And it's not a right or wrong thing, it's just a difference between him and Ezra. And yet, on this issue, they are absolutely very much alike one another. It says in verse 4, as soon as I heard these words, I sat down and wept and mourned for days, and I continued fasting and praying before the God of heaven. So just to reinforce how similar he is to Ezra, go back and look with me in chapter 9. What does Ezra do specifically when he hears about the issue of intermarriage in verse 3? In Ezra 9 and verse 3. Yeah, he sat down appalled, just like it says here in verse 4 of Nehemiah, that he sat down as soon as he hears it. You ever get that news and it just kind of staggers you to the point you take a seat? Well, that's kind of what happens here as well. Now, this is one of the differences in Ezra's case. He pulls his hair out. By the end of the book of Nehemiah, he's pulling other people's hair out. All right, so that's one of the differences in the book. We'll get to that here much later on here. So they are different, but they are similar in that both of them, as soon as they get this grievous word, they sit down. Also notice in chapter 10 and verse 1, while Ezra prayed and made confession, weeping and casting himself down. It reminds you of this language here. I sat down and wept and mourned for days and continued fasting and praying before the God of heaven. And Nehemiah 10:6 says that he withdrew and went and spent the night neither eating nor drinking. So I just want you to see this emphasis on prayer that I was bringing to mind from Ezra 10, reminding you of it again here at the start of class this morning. It's something that you also see here as well in the case of Nehemiah. The first response is to go to God in prayer. All right, so then the rest of Nehemiah 1 essentially gives us the text of his prayer. First of a couple of prayers that we're going to see here in the book of Nehemiah. So it starts off by saying, O Lord God of heaven, the great and awesome God who keeps covenant and steadfast love with those who love him and keep his commandments. Now, right off the bat, Nehemiah's language here is signaling to us sort of what's running through his mind as he prays. Because he's using here terminology that probably won't be as familiar to us. Although a couple of years ago we studied the book of Deuteronomy. We had a class just on the book of Deuteronomy. And as we start to go through this prayer of Nehemiah's, it's very clear that a lot of the language of his prayer is bubbling up from the book of Deuteronomy. I'll just show you a couple of easy ways to illustrate this. If you hold your place here, go over to the book of Deuteronomy, and I want you to look at the way God is described in Deuteronomy chapter 7. And as you're turning there, there's a very logical reason why you would be thinking about Deuteronomy. Deuteronomy, of course, gets its name. It's the second giving of the law. It's a succinct summary of all that the law of God was about the covenant God made with Israel. It's also the place that spells out, here are the blessings God will give you if you're faithful to the covenant, and here are the penalties, the cursings, as it says, if you are disobedient to the covenant, and then also promises after that. So there's a logical reason why this book would be on your mind. Also, the book of Deuteronomy is the book in the law that specifically says to the people, someday God is going to take you to a special place, and there he will put his name, referring ultimately, of course, to the city of Jerusalem. So for somebody worried about what's going on in Jerusalem, worried about God's faithfulness to his covenant, there are many reasons why Deuteronomy would be kind of on your mind. So if you turned over to Deuteronomy 7 and verse 21, the Lord says, you shall not be in dread of them, for the Lord your God is in your midst. Notice, a great and awesome God. Great and awesome. So that's the way that Nehemiah here, as he prays this prayer, describes the nature of God. We'll come back to Deuteronomy and look at a couple of other passages here in just a second. So after addressing God in these classic terms from Deuteronomy, here's what Nehemiah says, back over to Nehemiah 1 and verse 6. Let your ear be attentive and your eyes open to hear the prayer of your servant that I now pray before you day and night for the people of Israel, your servants, confessing the sins of the people of Israel, which we have sinned against you. Even I and my father's house have sinned. Now, what other similarity between Ezra's prayer that we looked at over in Ezra chapter 9, what other similarity do you see there and in the way that Nehemiah prays right here? All right, it's a confession of sin. That's exactly right. And what else do you notice about the way that they pray? Yeah, they include themselves. This was the point that we made back over in Ezra chapter 9 when he keeps saying, you know, we have done wrong, our sins, our iniquities. Although clearly Ezra himself had not intermarried with a foreign woman, but because he's representing the people, he is a part of a sinful people, and so he represents himself as a part of that collective group. Because it's not as if God has singled out, okay, you don't get to live in walls and you don't get to live in walls. It's collectively they don't get to live in a walled city right now because the enemies have broken them down. Well, the same thing here then in Nehemiah. Nehemiah includes himself as a part of this group, even though, by the way, he's hundreds of miles away, right? And he's in the palace. He's not a part of that group. But he also sees himself as one with the people. And so as somebody praying an intercessory prayer, he says, even I and my father's house have sinned. Continuing on to verse 7. We have acted very corruptly against you and have not kept the commandments, the statutes, and the rules that you commanded your servant Moses. So Nehemiah here seems pretty convinced that part of the reason why this catastrophe has happened is what? Because they've sinned. Yeah, because they've been unfaithful. Now, are we to assume from that anytime something goes wrong, that it's because God's punishing us because we've been unfaithful? Well, obviously not. We know that that's not the case. However, if you think in the big picture of a book like the book of Deuteronomy, we're going to see in just a second, Nehemiah is going to quote some language that's very specific, that God promises the people that after you're carried off into captivity, I will bring you back and establish you back in the land. Well, obviously, if they live in a city that's indefensible, they're not really established because they are wide open to any and all onslaughts. So in order for them to be able to truly believe, God has kept his promise to restore us. What would need to be the case is the city would need to be secure. Make sense to you? And if that hasn't happened, then what Nehemiah is concluding is there must be an element of our unfaithfulness that has played a role in this. And he's not the only person to draw these kinds of conclusions. Remember, when we looked at the initial construction of the temple in phase one, when it came to a halt and it lay dormant for a period of time, and the prophets, Haggai and Zechariah, come to stir the people, we actually learned something, didn't we, when we read over in Haggai chapter 1 that indicated that the people were in part culpable for what had taken place. Remember, what did Haggai say to them? Malachi says that. That's right. That's a whole other issue going on here, that they had abandoned some of this intermarriage was actually getting rid of their Jewish wives to marry some of these foreign women. And then when Haggai came to stir them up for the rebuilding of the temple, he raises an issue. There's a reason why this work has come to a halt, and it's not just what a foreign king has said. You remember what he says? Yeah, he says, you're so busy working on your own houses, you've lost sight of the importance of the house of God. So we need to be sure that we don't, you know, make some of these stories sometimes an all or nothing. Like it was either all foreign interference or all the sinfulness of the people. There's plenty of room for both and here. But insofar as sinfulness has played a role, it needs to be confronted and dealt with. That's what these prayers of confession are doing, is acknowledging to the extent that this is our fault. We need to confess and make things right. So then notice specifically this language here of Nehemiah in this prayer in verse 8, Nehemiah 1, 8. Remember the word that you commanded your servant Moses, saying, if you are faithful, I will scatter you among the peoples. But if you return to me and keep my commandments and do them, though your outcasts are in the uttermost parts of heaven, from there I will gather them and bring them to the place that I've chosen to make my name dwell there. All right, so do you remember, you Bible scholars, where in the book of Deuteronomy does God lay out the penalties? What will happen if you disobey the covenant? Very good. Who said that? Chapter 28. Was that Pat? Was it Ralph? I don't know. Was it Ed? Oh, okay. All right. So competition going on over there this morning. All right. So look over in chapter 28 of Deuteronomy. It starts off with the blessings. Here's what will happen if you're obedient to the covenant. That's 28, 1 through 14. But then starting at verse 15, but if you will not obey. And then it lays out all of these catastrophes, penalties, curses that will happen if they are unfaithful, including being carried off into exile. And then if you flip over to chapter 30, this is, it seems to me, and most commentators, this is what Nehemiah actually has in mind as he's praying when he talks about God's promise to bring exiles back. So Deuteronomy chapter 30, verse 1 says, when all these things come upon you, the blessing and the curse, which I've set before you, and you call them to mind among all the nations where the Lord your God has driven you, and return to the Lord your God, you and your children, and obey his voice and all I command you today with all your heart and soul, then the Lord your God will restore your fortunes and have mercy on you, and he will gather you again from all the peoples where the Lord your God has scattered you, if your outcasts are in the uttermost parts of heaven. See, that's the language here that Nehemiah has just used. From there the Lord your God will gather you, and from there he will take you. And the Lord your God will bring you into the land that your fathers possessed, that you may possess it and make you more prosperous and numerous and so forth. So when Nehemiah prays and says, Lord, remember what you promised us, that someday you would bring us back to the land and you would settle us in the land, bring us to possess the land. Well, obviously that hasn't been fully fulfilled yet because the walls of the city are in disrepair. And if you don't have walls, you don't have a city. And so we need your help. But he's calling to mind here the language of this promise in Deuteronomy chapter 30. And then when he talks about, back over Nehemiah 1, the place where your name is to dwell, as I mentioned, he's referring to another part of Deuteronomy. This is back over in chapter 12. Look over at chapter 12. Which, by the way, one of the reasons I wanted to go back and look at all these Deuteronomy passages is to help you see what Nehemiah must have had on his mind as he's praying. But there's a very important practical lesson about prayer here. If you are like me and you feel like you do not pray as you should, and you sometimes even struggle with where to begin as you pray, there is no better way to learn how to pray than to read the prayers of the Bible and pray them as your prayer. What do you mean pray them as your prayer? It's somebody else's words. You already do it every Sunday. When you sing songs, how many of you wrote these songs that we're singing? Not one of you, I don't think, right? Not one of you did. All right, unless my buddy Matt Bassford's in here. Nobody here wrote any of these words. And some of these words are hundreds of years old, but we take them and we sing them as our song. And by the way, a lot of these songs are prayers, incidentally, that we're praying. And all through the New Testament, you see, when Jesus prays on the cross, my God, why have you forsaken me? He's praying Psalm 22 and verse 1. So there's no better way to think about how to pray than to pray the prayers of the Bible. They're biblical, for sure, right? And that's what I want you to see. Really, what Nehemiah is doing is she's just wrapping together all these passages from Deuteronomy, and he's taking them to God. Here's what you promised us. So here in chapter 12 of Deuteronomy, verse 8, you shall not do according to all that we are doing here today, everyone doing whatever is right in his own eyes, for you have not as yet come to the rest and the inheritance the Lord your God has given you. But when you go over the Jordan and live in the land that the Lord your God has given you to inherit, and when he gives you rest from all your enemies around so that you live in safety, then to the place that the Lord your God will choose to make his name dwell there, there you shall bring all that I command you. So now when you come back over here to Nehemiah 1 and this prayer that Nehemiah gives, and we've just read this language from Deuteronomy 12, the place where God's name will dwell, and the language from Deuteronomy 30, the promise to return and restore the land, listen to this prayer again in light of those passages. This is verses 8 and 9 again. Remember the word that you commanded your servant Moses, saying, if you're unfaithful, I will scatter you among the peoples. But if you return to me and keep my commandments and do them, though you're outcast or in the uttermost parts of heaven, from there I will gather them, bring them to the place I've chosen to make my name dwell there. And there's actually a lot of other places in Deuteronomy that he's, I think, alluding to, but those are just some of the most significant ones. Everybody see that? Good to go? All right, so let's finish out the chapter. Verse 10, they are your servants and your people whom you've redeemed by your great power and by your strong hand. By the way, that word redeemed, if you're familiar with Exodus in the law, that should make all kinds of bells and whistles. That's the classic word used to describe what God is doing for Israel in the Exodus. So now he's going to do the same thing once again. O Lord, let your ear be attentive to the prayer of your servant and to the prayer of your servants who delight to fear your name, and give success to your servant today and grant him mercy in the sight of this man. Now, if you look in chapter 2 and verse 1, it's several months from Nisan, however you say that, that's the spring, that's the time of the year when it's Passover. So that's like March, April-ish. And remember, Kislev is November, December. So the point is, several months intervene between the end of chapter 1 and the start of chapter 2 before Nehemiah, quote, does anything other than humble himself in prayer before God. So he is doing something. He's doing something very important. All right, so the last detail we want to look at the end of the chapter, what do we learn about Nehemiah? So if there were sound effects in the Bible, we would have had very sad music playing all up into the very last part of that verse, and then we would hear dun-dun-dun, or maybe something in a major key, because this is great. Wait a minute, there's actually somebody who is right in the king's ear who can actually do something about this. So it's a good thing. The cupbearer, of course, we've all heard about these guys. The cupbearers You know, ostensibly he tastes the king's food to make sure it's not poisoned, but it's a much bigger position than that. In a non-biblical book called the Book of Tobit, there is a reference to someone who was a cupbearer. Then Ahikar interceded on my behalf, and I returned to Nineveh. He had been the chief cupbearer, keeper of the signet ring, treasury accountant, and credit accountant under Sennacherib, king of the Assyrians, and Esther hadn't appointed him as second to himself. So when you are the cupbearer, it's more than just you're the wine steward or the waiter. You're actually somebody, because of the intimacy of that relationship with the king, you are a trusted advisor and could, in certain circumstances, even be considered a very highly placed official. So that's how this chapter ends, on a very upbeat and positive note, in the face of all of this bad news about what's going on back in Jerusalem. There is the very good news that it just so happens this dude Nehemiah, that this news has just come back to, who's just prayed this marvelous prayer of repentance, just happens to be placed in a position where maybe he can get the king's ear and do something about this. So maybe he will. But in order to find out, you've got to come back Wednesday night. Or just read chapter 2 right now, and then you would know it then too. But either way, it's all good, and you'll see what happens here in the second chapter of Nehemiah. Okay, any final questions or comments as we wrap up class this morning from Nehemiah chapter 1? Yeah, Dean? Right.
The same with Ezra, he was his face and his demeanor. So it's like they know that they don't deserve anything, like what you're saying, but even their demeanor, like, can you please us that we've messed up? Illustrates that he ended with the mercy.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a great point, Dean. It's so clear that how they completely rely on the Lord. Unless the Lord builds the house, what's the rest of the verse? They labor in vain that build it. That's exactly right. And so that's what we're going to see here in Nehemiah.